tonight on Arena. In TV reviews, it's The Forsytes, Man vs. Baby and The Revenge Club, and we're talking about the best music, books and gigs of 2025. You're very welcome along to Friday Night's Arena. It is jam-packed, so let's get cracking. You can text us on 51551. Our WhatsApp is 0870 32 32 32. The email is arena@rte.ie, and we are on Instagram at @rte_arena. Now, The Revenge Club is a dark comedy thriller on Paramount Plus, adapted from J.D. Pennington's The Othello Club. Six heartbroken strangers who bond in a divorce support group. What starts out as helpful therapy turns into a vengeful scheme of revenge against their exes. And what starts as gleeful pranks spirals into deadly accidents. Netflix bring us Man vs. Baby, in which Rowan Atkinson returns as hapless Trevor Bingley in the sequel to Man vs. Bee. Post-divorce and unemployed, the bumbling dad takes a lucrative house-sitting job in a luxury London penthouse over Christmas. Things go awry, however, when he accidentally acquires a toddler from a school nativity play. And lastly tonight, The Forsytes is a lavish period drama based on the novels by John Galsworthy on Virgin Media TV. The series chronicles four generations of a wealthy stockbroking family in Victorian London, in which rival cousins Joylan and Soames Forsyte, played by Danny Griffin and Joshua Orpin, clash in love matters and business as well. Jen Gann and Chris Wasser have watched all of them for us. First up, Paramount Plus give us The Revenge Club. Six angry divorcees walk into a support group. Tell us, Jen, what happens next?
I mean, we love revenge. Who doesn't love? It's a delight to watch a bit of revenge, and especially, I guess, at this time of year where everybody's on their last nerve. So you want to see deserved people getting their comeuppance. So we have here, it sounds like fun. It does sound like fun. And the cast is stacked, because you've got Line of Duty's Martin Compton, Slow Horses, Amy Fiona Edwards, Shetland's Douglas Henschel. So it's not shabby when it comes to the acting stakes. But if you are expecting something like The First Wives Club, this is not exactly that. We begin with a flashback to the future, which I know Chris really enjoys when that happens in TV shows. So you have Emily, who's played by Amy Fiona Edwards. She's in a police interview room. And also, I really want to put an amnesty on seeing people in a police interview room in dramas in 2026. We've had enough this year. There's so many shows that have started with that this year. So you know that things are going to develop and get way more serious later on. But then I also think, why can't we just watch the show in chronological order and see that happen? But anyway, we drift back to her particular tale of woe. She finds out that her husband Dan is having an affair with her best friend Charlotte, and not only has she lost her husband, she's lost her best friend Charlotte, but the couple are also turfing her out of the marriage home, and Charlotte is also trying to take over her business. So it's enough to drive someone homicidal. She doesn't go homicidal as of yet, but she goes to this divorce support circle run by Malcolm, who's played by Amit Shah from Happy Valley. Malcolm, he has fairly unorthodox, you would say, and also extremely ineffectual methods, I would say. So it's not long before the group decamp to the pub afterwards and have a chat about what's going on in all their lives. And that's when they decide to hatch this strangers on a train. Make that. Make that next year. Anyway, so each of them are they're going to conspire to get revenge on each of their awful exes. And that sounds like a diverging, thrilling watch, and I truly wish that it was.
Okay, let's take something from it before we go any further. This is from The Revenge Club. It's Tej, who's Chenil Kolar, slipped in his wedding suit. Rachel Sharon Rooney says karma will get them. Steve Douglas Henschel speaks of revenge, and Callum Martin Compton says it's time Dan and Charlotte got a taste of their own medicine.
I slept in my wedding suit for a month after she dumped me.
I mean, why do they just get a move on? And we just sit here.
Karma will get them.
Yeah, karma's a concept.
But revenge. That's real.
Maybe it's time Dan and Charlotte got a wee taste of their own medicine.
You're not serious.
I'm sorry. You can't treat people like that and expect to get away with it. It's not right. Just, you know what I'm saying? Let's mess with them a little bit.
Chris, why do you think a human being starts off in the interrogation room of a police station somewhere and we then flash back to something that's happened trope just keeps getting bigger and bigger and bigger?
I don't know. I've decided that the week before the Christmas break, I'm not going to get too annoyed by this, despite the fact that when I was watching it and when we started in that police interview room, I wanted to throw the remote at the telly. It's too much and it's quite derivative and clumsy at this point. And I'm with Jen. Just tell the story in chronological order. And you know something terrible is going to happen here, but it's almost you're spoiling the story for the viewer too when you say that someone has died, and it feels as though that's an unnecessary element in the story. This is just actually based on a recently published novel by J.D. Pennington. J.D. Pennington having published his very first novel just this October. So the rights to this were obviously bought up quite a while before it actually came out. At no point in this series does it ever explain to the viewer how this group of people, why they all think they have no part to blame, or why they have no blame in the collapse of their marriages. They all think that they did nothing wrong, but it's never really explained how they get so good at the plotting and scheming so quickly. It's one thing for them all, whatever about the support groups, they don't really get much done there. It's in the pub over pints and cocktails. That's when they decide that they will be this, they won't be this divorce group, they'll be this revenge group. It's one thing to talk about getting revenge on exes. It's another to do the kind of things that these characters do in this series, and they very quickly become people that you cannot root for because their pranks aren't just fun and they're not fun to watch either. They're quite mean-spirited, they're quite manipulative. It goes from, basically spoiling the home of one ex to completely destroying the career of another, and then obviously someone ends up dead. So there comes a point halfway through the series where you think, I just can't root for them anymore. And another thing that I noticed in episode two, and I had to check this to see afterwards, was I seeing things? A Dublin bus goes by.
It does.
At one point. And this is set in the UK. And I thought to myself, have I just zoned out? Did I just imagine that? But no, this thing was actually partly filmed in Dublin. So what became fun for me wasn't what the Revenge Club was up to. What was fun for me was trying to spot where this thing was made, which parts of town it was in.
There are good actors here, Jen.
Great
okay, like
actors.
I said, Martin Compson, Amy Fionn Edwards, Mira Sal, Douglas Henshall. Do any of the performances drag it up from average level?
Kind of. Like the problem, I think, is the tone. It's as if the writers, they couldn't decide if they wanted to have this show be a high concept sitcom because there is supposed laughs here, or if they wanted to make it a comedic drama. I mean, it's too zany to be taken seriously. So that's where it kind of falls down. The dialogue is achingly self-conscious, I found. And I found it was just like a game of them trying to cram in as many sarcastic comments or as many adjectives into every line as possible. And, you lose then that kind of anyone to hold dear to you because there's no interior work really done. They're all sketches of people. I mean, Emily is a scorned woman. That's all she is. Callum, who's played by Martin Compton, he is the dad that just wants to do right by his daughter, and he's worried about he's going to lose her through the divorce. And they do err a little bit, I suppose, on the side of believable. They're not exactly three-dimensional, though. But then you have the walking whoopee cushion characters, which are Douglas Henshall's military man, replete with 1970s mustache, and then Sharon Rooney's loopy Rachel. Like, they are played for laughs. But then when we get this glimpse of what they're dealing with within their marriages, Rachel, it's coercive control. And then with Steve, Douglas Henshall's character, he's being torn down by his wife's new partner. It doesn't knit together properly because it doesn't give you that emotional sucker punch that you're supposed to have because the writing isn't there for that. It doesn't hit that mark. There's still this residual element of the oversized farce about it, and that is so sad. And I think we used to do this so well. This made me miss Kay Mellor so much. And if anybody knew, I think everybody in their lifetime has watched a Kay Mellor show, say The Syndicate or Band of Gold or anything like that, Fat Friends, which was hugely successful. There were shows with heart that had this ensemble cast of characters. You cared about every single one of them. There was a lot of laughs there, but it was written through frustration and anger. That was the writing, but it was played for laughs as well. And I think we've lost that in this writing. I don't know how this show has failed like that, because it should just be a knock it out of the park kind of show, and it's not.
Okay, here's the thing, Chris. It's the time of year and we're coming up to it, and I know we're going to be talking about it this day next week. Christmas TV, people will have a lot of time on their hands. kids, they will quite possibly watch an awful lot more TV than they would normally at any other time of the year. Is this going to find an audience?
I think it might, actually, because I can't help be cynical about it and think that the guys at Paramount Plus, they know exactly what they're doing, putting it out a week or two before Christmas, because unfortunately, this is the kind of TV that's so cheaply produced, so poorly plotted and written, and unfortunately, badly acted. And I don't think it's the fault of the actors. I think that's just the material that they're working with, that you start to think, this is TV that I'm supposed to watch while I'm doing something else. Mm-hmm. And you can easily imagine people putting up the tree and sticking on the Revenge Club, wrapping presents and sticking on the Revenge Club. You actually don't need to be watching the TV because while this thing is on to follow the plot, because the characters are spelling it out for you. So I think everyone involved knows what they're doing. If they thought that they had something decent, they would have put it out the other side of Christmas.
Okay, give me some stars.
I like this cast. I just don't want to be a member of their club, unfortunately. Worth it just to see, you know, parts of Dublin about the place. But can we not have people in a police interview room in 2026? And also Martin Compton, take a holiday. Maybe just do something else. I do like you, but he doesn't have to be in everything. 2 stars.
But he's back for Line of Duty, I suppose. Yes, we were going to see him again.
Okay, Jen.
I just think it's just too slapdash, and it's incredibly rote. It's incredibly predictable, and the revenge they're serving is freezing cold, and it's also reheating somebody else's nice dinner. So, 2.
Okay, that's the Revenge Club on Paramount. Chris, before we get started on Man vs. Baby, remind us again of Man vs. Bee, and why are we back with Rowan Atkinson's character again?
Well, there was a man in it and a bee, and they did indeed fight one another. A few years back, right after the pandemic, around 2022, so this thing actually would have been produced probably in the middle of things. You had Rowan Atkinson working with his Johnny English screenwriter, William Davies, to create a character who basically stages, you know, a war against a bee. This guy is a bit of a sad sack, Trevor Bingley, this bumbling middle-aged divorcee who hopes to raise basically enough funds to take his grown-up daughter Maddie on holiday. To do that, he accepts a gig with the house-sitting agency to look after this swanky mansion owned by a couple of rich head of balls, and he thinks this is going to be easy. When he walks into the house, he sees, you know, priceless artwork, and there's an expensive car in the garage. I mean, this show, there's so much Chekhov's gun principle at play here. If you see something expensive, it's going to be destroyed. If you come across a tricky alarm system, you know that Rowan Atkinson's going to get locked out of the house. But long story short, a bee got into the house, and over the course of these 9 slapstick-oriented episodes, Rowan Atkinson did everything he could to try and get the bee out, but it just completely destroyed the house in the process.
So how does that work with a baby?
Well, Trevor Bingley did actually survive that battle with the bee, and a few years later, he is still trying to make things right with his daughter. He is living alone in this quaint British countryside. He lives in this freezing house. It's the run-up to Christmas. He has found a new job as a caretaker at a school, but that job is coming to an end, unfortunately. And he's still low on money, and he's still trying to figure out, you know, how to basically fund his daughter's life. She needs £10,000 to go to the college of her dreams. He doesn't have it. But fortunately for Trevor, the house sitting agency calls. They say that there's a job for him in London, and that it's, you know, 10 grand in his pocket if he looks after another rich apartment. Before he can even get to that apartment, though, he comes across a baby at the school where he works in. Now, he thinks that this baby is, you know, just been left on the doorstep of the school for the nativity play. It hasn't. Nobody comes to pick up the baby.
Is that the sort of thing people do? They just leave on the doorstep?
Yeah,
just
apparently
at Christmas.
Yeah.
Just at Christmas.
At no point does anyone ever go, who baby is this? There's a huge big mix up about the identity, but a long story short again, he ends up looking after this baby. He ends up bringing it to London. You know, social services intervene, but they, you know, they don't even believe him because he keeps losing this baby. And every time he looks for the baby, he keeps saying, "Jesus, where are you?" So everyone just thinks he's, you know, a few tracks short of an album. So he ends up in this very rich house with this baby, keeps losing the baby. Away we go.
Okay, this is a clip from it, and this is where Gillian, the principal of St. Aldwyn's School, invites Trevor into her office for a little celebratory drink.
Okay, I'm outside.
Outside? What are you doing outside, Trevor? It's freezing.
Well, it's just the reception. It's a bit patchy around here, I'm afraid. But it's a lovely place, Jess. When you and Maddie come over, I'll show you the village, because they've got this wonderful...
That's actually why I'm calling, Trevor. We've had the most amazing invitation.
I think I might have mentioned my new boyfriend to you.
Goran?
Oh, yes.
Well, he's got this villa in Barbados, and, well, he's invited Maddie and me to join him there for Christmas.
Oh. So...
I thought it was just the perfect way to celebrate Maddie getting onto her course in Paris.
Right.
But it does mean flying out tomorrow, so I'm really sorry, but we won't be able to join you after all.
Oh. Okay.
But we'll be right back after New Year, so...
Why don't we aim to have a drink then?
Yes.
That's actually a moment where Trevor gets a call from his wife, Jess, who has disappointing news about Christmas, and that is Rowan Atkinson and Claudie Blakely. Okay. How does the humour differ to Man vs. Bee? I mean, it's a real baby. You can't really drop a baby. You can't fight with a baby. You can't. Jess, what happens here?
Yeah, this is the thing. Because, like, look, there was a chaoticness to Man vs. Bee, the original, and maybe the best, because he could just have, you know, do the whole Mr. Bean, the whole running after the bee, getting into terrible scrapes, physical comedy. But it would be completely awful to do that kind of style of comedy with a baby because you don't want to think about an injured baby. Yeah. It's not cute Christmas fare. So therefore, you get him doing mildly chaotic stuff like putting the baby in a laundry basket, using a cork from a champagne bottle as a soother, using an Hermes scarf as a nappy. But there is blatant product placement from Deliveroo and from an upmarket supermarket that it all just feels a bit airless, without any true tension. There's no opportunity for that certain brand of madness that Rowan Atkinson can bring. And there is chaos, but it's on this very gentle side and everything feels like it could be solved relatively easily. You don't have that cringe yourself inside out visceral feeling that you got when you watch Mr. Bean. It's not excruciating enough. It's very low stakes. It's very soft and it's very sweet. Like sweet as in icky. There was this sweetness about Man versus Bee as well, which I couldn't abide. And in the subplots of Man versus Baby, you have a couple, a young family, where you have Fleabag's Angus Imrie. He's this dad of a family that have lost their house. They're squatting in the basement of this salubrious apartment block, and Trevor tries in his own bumbling way to help them out. He manages to mix the babies up. He tries to solve poverty with a box of Cadbury's Heroes. Yet again, another clanging product placement, and it's all very seasonal and all very there's no room in the inn, but it's meaningless. As is, you have Cold Feet's Robert Baster's his turn. He's this long-term resident who's going to be ousted by the greedy Germans, that family who Trevor is house-sitting for. So there's this a race against time subplot there with that and with the German family coming back to the apartment.
I want to address the product placement thing, because you obviously feel the same way about this as I do, and it's happening an awful lot more both in movies and in TV these days, that you do see it and it immediately pulls you out of the narrative. You immediately stop thinking I'm currently in the middle of somebody's story.
Yeah, of course, because at one point in episode one, he looks at the box of heroes and says, "Ooh, these look nice." Stop. Like, just have an ad, Netflix. We know you're dying to have an ad, but you can't do it because that's just going to be like conventional telly. But yeah, they seep it in and it does stop you from what you're doing, what you're watching, the world that you're supposed to exist in. And this exists in one of those Love Actually fake versions of England picture postcard side of things, that it's just not a universe that is familiar. But I think that's the point of these stories, because they're almost akin with a silent film. There's very little dialogue in them. They're supposed to have this mass international feel for international audience. So that's why it feels very generic. And I think I said before, when I was on this very show reviewing Man vs. Bee originally, I said this is going to be a massive hit. And I think part of the reason why it's a massive hit, apart from it being so easy to follow, is the fact that Netflix have a very controversial way of ascertaining viewership, and these episodes are extremely short. They run about 20 minutes long, just over 20 minutes long. So inevitably they end up on their most watch list, because if you watch a couple of minutes of a Netflix show, it counts as a watch. So it does feel like this very horrible, cynical exercise to me.
It's kind of disappointing for me. I'm always looking out for something that's about 23, 24 minutes and I can laugh on something that will... The thing about this, Chris, is I feel this could also fall into the category of something you could stick on in the background while you're doing other things at Christmas.
Absolutely. I mean, watching Rowan Atkinson fall over will never not be funny. It's just the joke gets that little bit more tired every time he does it. And whereas Mr. Bean was, you know, awkward and elaborate and hilarious, this is just a little bit too awkward. And I just, you know, I hate giving, you know, Rowan Atkinson a bad review because it's Blackadder, it's Mr. Bean, but he's just, there's nothing here that we haven't seen before. I mean, when he was changing the baby's nappy, I started to think to myself, this is a Mr. Bean story. Mm. He actually did this in Mr. Bean. The jokes are so heavily signposted that you find yourself shouting at the telly, but I will say one thing that might get me into trouble, you know, or that might just be, you know, going against the tide. I actually did feel more watching this than any other show this week, because when you're watching a baby climb a stairs and Rowan Atkinson's Trevor Bingley is downstairs and he can't get up into the apartment, that's terrifying. So it did make me feel something. Most of the time though, it was probably just annoyance.
How many stars is that worth?
2 stars. I'll see you back here for Man versus Truck or something like that. Yeah.
Man versus Bigger Baby.
Yeah.
Yes.
I mean, it has the feel of Gather the Family Fair for, you know, Christmas time, but I do think that's probably insulting the intelligence of children. This is a very vague ploy at trying to make it feel festive, but for me, it had all the sentimentality of putting some tinsel around a toilet bowl. 2.
You don't do that?
Not yet.
Finally, this week, we go to Virgin Media TV. It's a new adaptation of The Forsythes. It's not the first adaptation of John Galsworthy's Forsythe saga. Chris, tell us about this one.
So this one starts off with a very lavish wedding to introduce the Forsythe clan to anyone who might not be familiar with it. And that, I'm sorry to say, includes me, because I'm not familiar with the original. I've never read the original novels. I somehow managed to miss the 1967 BBC series, probably because I wasn't around at the time, but I've never gone back to it. The 2002 ITV hit, which was huge again on Netflix with Damian Lewis. So much Forsythes in the world, and I've never really sat down with them before. But thankfully, everything explained is explained very quickly in this very rushed opening sequence, where you have Anne Forsythe, who's sort of like the Maggie Smith of the played by Francesca Annis, the Maggie Smith of this Forsythe saga. She is the wise and wealthy matriarch of the Forsythe clan, these wealthy stockbrokers who are the poshest, most powerful, and in some cases the most dangerous people in this part of London. And they are marrying off the heir to the Forsythe family business, Jolyn Joe Forsythe, played by Danny Griffin, to this respected widow named Frances, played by Tuppence Middleton. By marrying Frances, he also becomes a stepfather to her daughter. And it's basically these two powerful families coming together. What will happen between them, and what will this mean for the business? We then fast forward 10 years to a time, Rick, when nobody but the kid has aged even a day. There is not a hair out of place. There is no grey in sight. And you have this case where Joe and Frances are maybe happily married. Maybe they might be in love. The youngster is about to come of age, which means she's going to be presented to society and everyone's going to try and find a male suitor for her. Joe is about to inherit his father's business. The senior Joe is played by Stephen Moyer from True Blood. But in comes this dressmaker from Ireland, played by Eleanor Tomlinson, from Poldark, because this is actually from the makers of Poldark, to completely throw a grenade into the mix. Now, is it a spoiler to say that Eleanor Tomlinson's character is a character from Joe's past? I'm not sure if, you know, everyone who...
Why would they introduce her if they were not going to throw back grenade?
Yeah, I mean, you just know straight away. Yeah, she is a character from his past because he wasn't always a business type. He kind of, you know, kicks it back against everything the guys in his family are into. You know, they're all about business. They like to see smaller businesses crumble so that they can stay ahead. He is more of an arty type. He traveled the world. He didn't want to be part of this business. So let's just say that having someone from his past re-enter the picture, it completely messes with things.
Okay, let's take something from it. This is Frances and Joe Forsythe discussing possible suitors for their daughter June, who's about to turn 18, Tuppence Middleton, and Danny Griffin playing the parents, with Francesca Annis as Anne Forsythe.
What do we think of Charlie Armstrong?
Is that Sir Roger's boy?
Mm-hmm. For what?
For June.
Does she like him?
She's never met him. But I've invited the Armstrongs to the ball. Along with the Latimers.
Tea.
Palisters.
Railways.
Carterets.
Land.
It's a question of who would most benefit the family. Miles Latimer. Horatio Carteret.
The Prince of Wales?
I'm serious. Hurry with your breakfast. We have an appointment in town.
Where?
The dressmaker. Your gown for the ball?
Pretty good, to be fair.
It is.
It is. Yeah.
Now, where were we? So look, tell me about it, Jess, what you make of this, because the series focuses mostly on men making money, women making love matches, as was the fashion at the time.
Yeah, I mean, look, it's not Downton. And the thing about it is, Debbie Horsfield, she revived Poldark. And you would think she has a knack for doing that. Like, she'll get those 70s relics and re-establish them. And we all saw, you know, Aidan Turner's topless escapades in Poldark, which probably had something to do with its success, I will say. And this time around, I think what they're relying on is Danny Griffin and his hair. He has this bountiful hair and he has an iPhone face. His face does not belong in the 19th century. He looks like he's been dropped in from Knots Landing or Footballers' Wives. And it's not his fault, but it does feel really
it's
incongruous.
It's just the way he looks, surely.
It's really incongruous, especially they have this multitude for no reason in boxing scenes where they're just randomly thrown into the plot to give it that Poldark spice, but it's not the same. And I'm thankful that he is paired with Tuppence Middleton, because if anyone knows their way around this corset restraint stuff, it's her, and she's great and she's always good. And this is the problem yet again, you have a really good cast here. You've got Jack Davenport, who I adore, who is whooping it up here. I mean, he needs a mustache to twirl. Yes. And you're not giving a spoiler away at all, Chris, because at one point in the first episode he talks to Francis and says, you know, that getting married might put a halt to Joylan's running amok in Europe. So you're thinking, what's going on here? Something's happening here. And then when Louisa does appear, Poldark's Eleanor Tomlinson, you can almost hear the EastEnders duff duffs towards the end of the first episode. So it is super soapy, and I'm making it sound a lot more fun than it is. I wish it leaned into its more tackier sensibilities, because they are there. It's not lush enough to make it an elevated costume drama, and I am surprised that she couldn't make this material work, because I mean, Galsworthy won a Nobel Prize for Literature for this series of books, and you don't get that from this show at all. I mean, I've seen more dramatic events unfold in Doc Cotton's living room than what we have here. So I don't know about this at all, unfortunately.
I'm going to play one more clip from this, and it does feel almost like mustaches are being twiddled in this. This is at a board meeting. The family gathered to discuss business strategy. Joe Forsythe and his father, Joe Sr., attend. They're played by Danny Griffin and Stephen Moyer, and Joe's cousin, Soames Forsythe, and his father, James, here, are played by Joshua Orpin and the great Jack Davenport.
For half a century, we have been preeminent among London's stockbroking elite. But lately, young upstarts have been snapping at our heels. So how do we maintain our supremacy? By not resting on our laurels. By seeking out new investments, new markets. By keeping our ear to the ground for information that we may be able to turn to our advantage.
I have something.
Soames.
Sir Roger Armstrong, Durham Mining Co., is about to croak.
Good God, he's barely 50.
Of course, the family's keeping it close to their chest.
Who'll be taking over?
The young lad, Charlie Armstrong.
Well, that wastrel. Never done a day's work in his life.
Precisely the point. When the news breaks, the share price will plummet.
Not necessarily. Could hold steady, provided there's no loss of confidence.
We should sell. Our stock, client stock.
Thus ensuring loss of confidence.
So where do you suggest our loyalties lie?
You know as well as I, a massive sale of stock will panic the markets.
And some of our clients have their entire savings invested with us.
If enough shareholders got together, they could force the company to appoint a steadier hand. Confidence could be restored.
Evil capitalists have always been around. Let's get stars from you, Jess.
I want an involved period drama for Winter Nights. I don't know if I'll be clocking back into this so soon, but it's diverting enough. I'll give it a 2.5.
Chris.
Yeah, I think it's just the same as the last two shows. The problems start on the page, so we mustn't blame the actors too much. But with regards to Danny Griffin, I don't wish to be mean. We are coming up to Christmas. That guy does look as though he was assembled in the same factory where they made the Hemsworth brothers.
Totally.
And good luck to him. Fair play to him. Congratulations. But he's so out of his depth here. I'm going to give it an extra star for Eleanor Tomlinson's Irish accent. I thought she nailed it. It's terrific. Jack Davenport always gets a round of applause. But it's a huge letdown. 2 stars.
Okay, Jess Gannon and Chris Wasser, thank you so much for joining us. The Revenge Club is on Paramount Plus, Man vs. Baby is on Netflix, and The Forsythes on Virgin Media TV and Virgin Media Play. Now, it's Friday evening. Normally, this is our weekly review of the latest new album releases. But as we're close to Christmas, that all gets a little bit quiet. So we've asked Eamon Sweeney to choose his favourite books of the year and John Marr to choose the best gigs that he attended. You're both very welcome. John, I'm going to start with you about gigs in general this year. So ticket prices through the roof. We all started to become aware of dynamic pricing this year as well. Beyond all that, what about the music? What about the sheer joy, the sheer exaltation of standing next to your fellow man and seeing an artist?
There was some very special gigs this year. I mean, in a way, there's only one place to start, and that's the obvious place, and that's Croke Park in the middle of August for Oasis, because it was the most anticipated gig of the year. You mentioned dynamic pricing. A lot of people spent a great deal of money to get into that show. But I'll tell you something, Rick. I cannot remember a stadium show with an atmosphere like that. It was extraordinary. Even before they came on stage, Richard Ashcroft was on before them. Cast were on before him. But for Richard Ashcroft, the atmosphere just rose to a point where I thought, can this sustain itself for 2 hours of Oasis? It absolutely did. I was sitting with lots of other reviewers in the Hogan stand, and straight away, everybody around us, everybody in the entire stadium was on their feet, and they stayed there for the whole night. It was brilliant. And I had been sceptical. I'd seen Liam Gallagher the previous year in the Three Arena. I thought his voice was fantastic, much better than it was back in when he was in his 20s. But I wondered, would it work in the huge surrounds of Croke Park? It really did. It was very special. Think of all those people without tickets on Jones's Road for both nights, listening to what was happening. The pop-up store, which is kind of still there. I passed it the other day in Stephen's Green when the Lewises were down. Like, the whole country just got caught up in Oasis mania, and it could have been a damn squib. It wasn't. It was brilliant.
Luckily, we have something from that gig, because Oasis have been putting out individual tracks, and you'll find them on the streaming services of your choice. This is Oasis from the first night, from the 16th of August gig in Croke Park, doing Wonderwall. Oasis Wonderwall from the 16th of August gig in Croke Park. Were you there, Eamon?
Yeah, I was there on the second night. John was there on the first, and it was one of my favourite descriptions of it. It was like a dam bursting. The emotion, the songs poured out of everybody. I have never, ever, ever. The only thing remotely close to it would probably be U2 at Slane in 2001 on that Saturday afternoon where Jason McAteer scored that goal. That, you know, to qualify Ireland for the World Cup in 2002, and the emotion of that day with the recent death of Bono's father. This was similar but entirely different. This, as John just said, the whole country went Oasis crazy for those two sun-kissed days and two really highly emotional nights. It was amazing. And that virtual clip of, I think it's Half a World Away, where people are singing along without tickets with the train passing, and somebody had captioned it of kind of like about the spirit of Irish people, of not being able to get in, and all the hype about dynamic pricing, and it was a bit ugly, to be honest, but getting on with it and enjoying the moment, going, Oasis lit a fire and Irish people followed it, you know. And it's something that will live me forever. Like, interesting enough, three 90s icons really probably were amongst my kind of favourite shows of the year. Radiohead in the O2 in London, and My Bloody Valentine in both the Three Arena in Dublin and Wembley Arena in London as well.
You're here to talk about books, and you're starting with books that refer to Oasis as well.
Yeah.
I mean, this is a great time of year for people who do get more, as we were saying in the TV item earlier. They will get a chance to watch some more TV, probably read a little bit more as well.
Yeah.
So you've got some music books from the last year. They're all worth buying for somebody else or for yourself if you love the bands involved. Before I do that, what are the joys of a really good, either book about music or a music biography or autobiography? What does it have to have?
A really good one. And partly because of COVID and partly because of streaming record revenues being down, everybody's bringing out a book. And a lot of them are kind of hackneyed, lots of pictures in the middle, lots of names dropping, anecdotes. Two from me, which kind of would be very influential in 2010 when Keith Richards published Life. And then in 2016, Bruce Springsteen's Born to Run and talking about his depression. I think both those raised the bar, and publishers have got really savvy to publishing good music memoirs and good books about music. I only really have one memoir in kind of my top five of the year. What makes a good music book is also, and I will touch upon this when I talk about The Royal We by Roddy Bottom of Faith No More, the story is just so sensationally good and the writing is so sensationally good. The fact whether that you're a fan of the band or the artist or the or not, it's kind of besides the point. It's such a good read.
I think one key attribute of a great music book is if it sends you back to the music and you're listening to it anew, or you're discovering brand new tracks or albums or whatever. That to me is one of the great parts of it. And I totally echo what you said earlier.
I think we definitely have something of that in this. So tell me about the Oasis books to begin with.
There's two here. Now, look, there was a whole slew of them out this year. Now, the Gallaghers didn't even do a single press interview, which is kind of extraordinary by their standards because they're very good at it. And believe me, I've tried. I'm sure John has tried
well.
They did nada. They didn't have to. So they sold all the tickets. And in this vacuum, I think this encouraged probably publishers to make more and more. And some of the books are okay. Some of them are very poor. But these two are pretty good. The first one, Gallagher, the Fall and Rise of Oasis by PJ Harrison, published by Little Brown. It very much focuses on the solo careers in between, how it came together, and a lot of their personal lives and a lot of their lives as children and domestic abuse, and a lot of quite interesting psychological profiling of both Noel and Liam. And one amazing coup of a revelation that this was a meticulously planned reunion. And in addition to, it's rumoured they're splitting about 100 million, so about 50 million each. But that's going to be small change, because Noel Gallagher this year and in the coming months is acquiring his back catalogue in full from Sony. And like people like Dylan, like Neil Young, like Bruce Springsteen, it's believed that he's going to kind of sell this to a higher bidder and cash in while he's still alive and give it to his estate. So we're looking at least 250 million quid.
Okay,
that's in Harrison's book, which is
give me the second Oasis book as well, because that's interesting too.
This is more about the music. A Sounds Are Very Loud, the inside story of every song Oasis recorded by Hamish McBay and Ted Kessler. Ted Kessler, I've been a big fan of for years. He used to be the editor of Q magazine.
Daniel Kessler's
exactly,
brother.
Exactly, from Interpol.
Yeah,
which is amazing bit of trivia. And great writer, loved his first book. But this one, now the flaw is, obviously the good Oasis songs are generally the first two albums, and let's say the B-sides, the Master Plan compilation. Now, I read the title again. The inside story of every song Oasis recorded. Therein lies the flaw.
It's chunky, I presume.
Yeah, it's fairly chunky, and it does every bloody one. I think even Noel Gallagher would kind of go, do you really have to do every single one? You know, we had our fair share from Post Be Here Now onwards.
Fair share of duds, I think.
Yeah. Now, look, there's an odd late one. Like John was saying there about sending you back to the music. I was kind of going, oh yeah, forgotten about the Shock of the Lightning. And you put it, okay, God, that is really good. That is a bit of a, you know, a gem from the later years that I had forgotten about, for example. This be very much more for the Oasis completist in your life. For that reason, the first book, Harrison's book, would be kind of maybe a little bit more of the kind of the juicy kind of read about the Gallaghers.
Okay, so that's Gallagher, The Fall and Rise of Oasis by PJ Harrison, and A Sound So Very Loud, the inside story of every Oasis song recorded by Hamish McBay and Ted Kessler. We're going to take a break and have some more after these. And you're listening to Friday Night's Arena. I've got John Maher talking about his gigs of the year and Eamon Sweeney about best music books of the year as well. John, you went to see Pulp at the Comeback Show at the Three Arena. Why did you enjoy them so much?
Oh, well, first of all, the album that they returned with is really good. Spike Island, that song is fantastic. It echoes back to Sort of for Ease and Wiz from the mid-90s. And I suppose, unlike My Bloody Valentine and Oasis, they arrived after a long hiatus with new material, which was really great, and lots of new material. And I was really struck as well, the Jarvis, obviously there's a kind of Dorian Gray thing going on there, because while the rest of the band really have aged, he hasn't. He still looks the same, and he's still shouting and pointing to quote one of his lyrics. I really enjoyed it.
I really enjoyed it too. Yeah, I was there that night. They played St. Anne's a couple of years ago. That was a stonking gig as well. They've always been a good live act in my experience, but that gig, the Three Again gig that John has singled out, and there was an interval in the middle, and it felt so... What a catalogue. Like, yes. It was such an all basis.
Yeah.
It was a long, long show in a good way.
No, oh, totally, that's not yeah. No, absolutely. No,
yeah. Yeah, I want to play something. Pulp, and that's Spike Island on Arena. Eamon, another beloved band this time, the Manic Street Preachers. I talked to Keith Cameron about this earlier this year here on Arena. Remind us of the book.
The book is called 168 Songs of Hatred and Failure, A History of Manic Street Preachers. And Keith Cameron has been a fantastic music journalist from, you know, way back in the glory NME days of the 90s. This is along the lines, I suppose, to give listeners a reference point. Ian MacDonald did an excellent book called Revolution in the Head, The Beatles Records and the 60s, that did a song-by-song approach and uncovered not just all the Beatles music, but all this amazing stuff about social history and sociology and what it was like to be alive then. And this is similar. I'm reading, you know, going back, reading it, and kind of all these reference points of Neil Kinnock and Margaret Thatcher and the miners' strike and all these kind of different things about the 80s and about the 90s. And also, a great thing about the Manics, they're a very bookish band. Now, we started our conversation about Oasis, not a particularly bookish band, but, you know, they read all the album sleeves and single sleeve had loads of quotes from authors and artists and all this kind of stuff. There's a great energy to this book. And I love this kind of episodic song-by-song approach. And, you know, take a song like If You Tolerate This, Then Your Children Will Be Next. And Nicky Wire just kind of talking about literally having been on holidays in Barcelona with his wife the first time the two of them were away in ages. And then he just soaks up all this stuff. And he said it just kind of wrote itself. Lots of revelations about the musicianship, about the art of songwriting, about lyric writing. A very dense book. As you can see, it's something I've really thumbed a lot this year. And again, echoing what John was saying, brings it back to the music time and time again.
Okay, that is 168 Songs of Hatred and Failure, A History of the Manic Street Preachers by Keith Cameron. I'm conscious that all we've done is talk about bands of a certain age who have played guitar. So let's do Sharon Van Etten at Collins Barracks for one of your gigs. Why was that, John?
Yeah, that was in August. Wider Than Pictures, which is a wonderful kind of a series of one-night events in Collins Barracks, which is one of those great outdoor Dublin venues, and she was really excellent. Very fine band, a beautiful setting. I saw some amazing female fronted gigs this year for something entirely different, and for somebody who is incredibly physical in terms of her just the sheer movement on stage. Dua Lipa in the Aviva Stadium. In my review, I mentioned that Tommy Bow wasn't as fast as this woman, and he didn't have to wear high-heeled boots. I mean, it was extraordinary, the amount of energy that was there. I took my young daughter to it. She loved it. Everybody around me loved it. The energy was amazing. Last weekend, CMAT, who had an amazing year, very strong album in Euro Country, her third album, it was a homecoming show in Dublin. Crowd were so up for it. Just a sense of somebody who is seizing the moment. She's playing a big outdoor festival in Dublin next year, and she's kind of ready. And it's exciting. It's a bit like Fontaines over the past couple of years, when you see somebody that's really grown to the point where they know they're one of the world's big acts now, and they're loving it.
Okay, I want to play some of the Sharon Van Etten, maybe for people who don't necessarily know her. Here we go. And that's Trouble by Sharon Van Etten here on Arena. We're going to go back to books. Eamon, you've chosen Blitz, The Club That Created the 80s by Robert Elms. What's that about?
That's about a club in Covent Garden that was run by Steve Strange and a London Irish DJ called Rusty Egan, and who later formed Visage. Fade to Grey is supposed to be their most notable hit. Midger was also involved in that. Blitz was founded in 1979, and many kind of say there was kind of when the 80s began, and which reminds me of what the late Tony Wilson said about the Stone Roses' Happy Mondays being on the top of the Pops in 1989 is when the 90s began. But the beauty of this is it's really something I've really enjoyed the most this year. because it's so evocative of London for a start, the 80s, social history. Robert Elms, I suppose, for those who don't know him, he used to write for The Face, and he's a very noted broadcaster on BBC London. He's done a show there for years that chronicles London and its fashion and its culture and its music. And he's no stranger to writing books as well. The Way We Wore was a kind of like an acclaimed kind of a book about clothes that he wrote. He's really into clobber. Blitz was this kind of melt, you know, this intersection of all of that. It was all about being dressed up, and Steve Strange would turn you away if you weren't dressed up enough, as he did to Mick Jagger from the Rolling Stones. It wasn't, I believe, it was an amazing club. I was about to say I was never there, but this coincides with a great exhibition in the Design Museum in Kensington, where also the Wes Anderson Archives is on at the moment as well, where you can actually, it recreates the dance floor and the club, and you're there
dancing in a gallery
to Rusty Egan with his red hair playing Kraftwerk and Spandau Ballet and all this stuff. It's a really great book for anybody who loves 80s music. Sweet Dreams by Dylan Jones is kind of like an oral history of that period. It would be a great companion volume to that, but so, so readable, so well done. Also, speaking of The Face, there was a brilliant exhibition in the National Portrait Gallery in London about that too. The club came to the gallery this year, and the club is in this brilliant book as well.
I'm conscious we haven't mentioned festivals, John, at all. Was it a good year for festivals?
It was, but there was also concern that there was an oversaturation. Like, there are too many festivals here. There were one or two of them were very close to going to the wall. Just for legal reasons, I'm not going to necessarily mention them. But the people were jittery this year. The biggies, the Electric Picnics of this world, are absolutely fine. It's the smaller ones that will struggle. And I think we're going to see a lot more of that last year. From a Dublin point of view, I really liked In the Meadows. It's very hard not to enjoy Iggy Pop in all his pomp late at night, particularly when I live a kilometre away.
Hasn't that become part of the consideration these days? How far do I have to travel?
It has. Camping, it's a long time since I've done camping.
And I wanted to mention as well the RTE Concert Orchestra collaborations that they're doing. You really liked the David Bowie one.
I did. I mean, Bowie, it's hard to believe that we're coming up to 10 years since his death.
Wow.
But there was a fantastic show in the Three Arena with people like Shobsy and Fair Rourke of Soda Blonde and Duke Special performing the songs of Bowie, and an eclectic set of songs from Bowie, not the obvious ones, and with a concert orchestra providing beautiful soundtrack to it. And it just, again, felt very evocative of various stages of that man's life and a reminder of his extraordinary talent, but also that ability to constantly reinvent himself, which often is lacking today.
Okay, I want to finish out with a book. I want you to mention the Kate Mossman book from
Yes,
if you can, Eamon.
Absolutely, because I'm very conscious of the fact I'm a bloke talking about blokey music, all these books written by blokes. And this book has got the amazing title of Men of a Certain Age, My Encounters at Rock Royalty by Kate Mossman, who, for my money, about 10 years ago, I was reading the New Statesman. She interviewed the artist formerly known as Terence Trent D'Arby. Oh my God. Sensational interview, a textbook, you know, textbook about how you do it, how you let your subject speak. Absolutely brilliant, brilliant journalist. So she speaks to Roger Tay and Brian May from Queen, Sean Ryder from Happy Mondays, John Bon Jovi, and makes him sound interesting. Dave Gahan of Depeche Mode, Nick Cave, Sting, Bruce Hornsby. She's amazing. She's a great, great writer. And look, if you want a taste of it, check out her stuff on the New Statesman website, especially the Terence Trent D'Arby one. You'll love it.
And if I could throw in a few books that I love this year from a music point of view, we mentioned Dylan Jones. His book 1975 is very interesting about the music of that year. Before punk broke, he argues that it's been forgotten about. There's some incredibly eclectic stuff. Paul McCartney's Wings book, kind of an oral history, is very interesting as well. And the book I suppose I liked most from a music point of view was Peter Doggett's book on the Beach Boys, in which it's not just about Brian Wilson but all five members. He really is kind of, and he's fair to all five of them because some of them are lampooned.
I'd love to give a mention to as well, because we talked to him again on the show a couple of months ago, Night People, How to Be a DJ in 90s New York City by Mark Ronson, about the early part of his career, about when he was just a club DJ and doing all that kind of stuff. So lots to buy, lots to think about, lots of gigs that we enjoyed this year. Thanks to both of you. You'll be back with us for Arena's Christmas Arts Quiz on December the 22nd.
Mm-hmm. How are you feeling about that, James?
Nervous, but I'm sure
excited.
Eamon will be fantastic.
See, me and John have a bit of PTSD when it comes to Christmas quizzes. I won't bore you all listeners with the full details, but yeah, it was emotional, should we
it
say,
was,
John?
Yeah, it was an argument at the end, not with us, but with other people. So we take these things seriously.
I very much could say we'll go gently on you, but that would be a lie. Thank you so much to Eamon Sweeney and John Maher. That is it for Arena for this week. We'll see you on Monday night from 7 o'clock again here on Radio 1. Tonight produced by Reg Luby. Paula Shields is our researcher. Ollie Hamilton, the broadcast coordinator. Sound supervision tonight by the great Damien Chanels. And I will talk to you on Monday. Good luck.